Lecture 11, The Importance of Interpretation.
We saw in the previous lecture that Christianity from the outset was a text-based religion, and that Christians therefore had to decide which books are sacred. But knowing which books are sacred provides no guarantee that everyone will agree on what to believe. The problem is that different interpreters can interpret the same book in different ways. This is obvious even today, given the fact that different Christians from different churches interpret the New Testament in radically different ways. The Southern Baptists interpret the New Testament quite differently from the Catholics. The Lutherans interpret it differently from the Mormons. The Episcopalians from the Seventh-day Adventists. And this is true not just of the New Testament or other sacred books, but of all books altogether. Just consider the wide-ranging interpretations of Shakespeare or the American Constitution. The problem is that written texts are never self-interpreting. They always require human beings to interpret them. And human beings have different views, beliefs, values, priorities, worldviews, ideas, and so on. And all these things affect how one reads a text. Thus, the same text can mean different things to different people. And so, for early Christians, to ensure that the right beliefs would be held, they had to do more than choose which books were authoritative. They also had to determine how these books were to be interpreted. The problem was well recognized in the early centuries of Christianity, as different groups interpreted the same scriptures in radically different ways. The famous heretic Marcion, for example, whom I talked about in the previous lecture, used a literal interpretation to discredit the writings of the Hebrew Scriptures, which for other Christians were the sacred Old Testament. If you remember, Marcion believed that the Jewish Scriptures were the Scriptures of the Jewish God who had created the world and called Israel to be his people. But these Scriptures were not to be the Scriptures of the Christians, because the Christians worshipped the other God, the God who had sent Jesus into the world to save Christians from the God of wrath described in the Old Testament. And so Marcion had as his sacred books something like our Gospel of Luke and something like our letters of Paul. In fact, he had all of our letters of Paul except for the pastoral epistles, 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus. That was his canon of Scripture, the letters of Paul and something like our Gospel of Luke. He nonetheless read the Old Testament. He read the Old Testament precisely because he wanted his understanding of the Old Testament to show that the God of the Old Testament could not be the God of Jesus. To show this, Marcion read the Old Testament in a very literalistic way. To show that the God of wrath that the Old Testament portrays simply cannot be the God proclaimed by Paul and Jesus before him. One of Marcion's most famous writings was a book called The Antitheses. The word antitheses means contrary statements. In this book, The Antitheses, Marcion tried to show that a literal reading of the Old Testament, when compared with a literal reading of Paul and Jesus, the writings of Paul and the teachings of Jesus, contradicted one another, so that they stand in a contrary relationship to one another. They are antithetical. This showed that the God of the Old Testament could not be the God of Jesus. Let me give you a couple of examples. We don't actually have the antitheses anymore. We don't have Marcion's writing. We have it only as it was quoted in some of the church fathers, but there are places where we're able to reconstruct what Marcion's antitheses said and thereby reconstruct what he had to say about the relationship of the Hebrew Bible to the teachings of Jesus and Paul. Marcion maintained that the God of the Old Testament simply could not be the same God Jesus talked about. For example, the God of the Old Testament, after the Exodus, tells the children of Israel to go into the promised land and to take it for themselves. Well, the problem was, of course, that somebody already lived in the promised land. What were the Israelites to do about that? According to the book of Joshua, they were to kill the people in the promised land. And so in the famous story of the Battle of Jericho, we're told that God instructed Joshua to have the people of Israel march around the city of Jericho that was inhabited by the Canaanites. They're to march around the city once a day for 7 days. And on the seventh day, they're to march around the city 7 times and then to blow their trumpets. And then the walls of Jericho will fall down. And when the walls of Jericho fall, the children of Israel are to invade the city, attack it, and murder every man, woman, and child in the city. Joshua does so at the commandment of God. They destroy all the inhabitants of Jericho. And Marcion asks, is this the same God who says, love your enemy? Is this the same God who says, if somebody strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also? Is this the same God who says, pray for those who persecute you? Jesus taught about a God of love and mercy and forgiveness. The God of the Battle of Jericho is anything but a God of love, mercy, and forgiveness. These simply cannot be the same God, based on a literal interpretation of the Jewish scriptures. Or take a second example. In the Hebrew Bible, there's a passage in the book of Kings about the prophet Elisha. Elisha is walking by a group of boys, and these boys start making fun of him. Elisha apparently was going bald, and these boys call out, Baldy, Baldy. This irritates the prophet of God, who calls God's wrath down upon these children, and there emerges from a nearby forest 2 she-bears who come up against the boys and attack them and maul 46 of them. Is this the same God who said, let the little children come unto me? Surely it's a different God. The God of the Old Testament cannot be the God of Jesus, the God of Paul. Marcion's conclusion was that what he considered to be a straightforward, literal interpretation of the Old Testament shows that the gospel of Jesus, especially as it was proclaimed by Paul, is not the same as the law and the gospel proclaimed in the Old Testament. The Jewish Bible, in other words, is not to be accepted as Christian scripture. And so Marcion had a canon of scripture. He had a collection of sacred books that he thought were authoritative, Luke and 10 letters of Paul, with no Old Testament. The Old Testament is the scripture of the Jews. It's not the scripture of the Christians. This view, of course, did not end up winning out. This view ended up losing to the Christians who insisted that the Jewish heritage is important to hold on to. Christians insisted that Jesus himself was Jewish, that he was a Jewish teacher who taught the true meaning of the Jewish law. Christians eventually held on to the Old Testament, but they had to interpret the Old Testament in light of their Christian faith. And so, eventually, Christians came to teach that the Old Testament and the New Testament gods are, in fact, the same God and can be reconciled with one another over against the teachings of Marcion. Marcion's views were not the only ones that lost out. There were a large number of various Christian groups in the 2nd and 3rd and 4th centuries who held views that eventually came to be eliminated by the victorious party. I mentioned in the previous lecture that it's difficult to define the terms orthodoxy and heresy because everybody thinks they hold the right beliefs. In other words, everybody thinks they are orthodox. Historians continue to use these terms, however, not in their etymological sense to indicate which group was right and which group was wrong. In other words, when historians talk about the orthodox form of Christianity, they're not saying the view that was right, because historians have no access to which view is right. Historians have no access to whether there's only one God or 2 gods or 30 gods or something else. Historians can only describe what happened in history. One of the things that happened in history is that one group of Christians ended up winning the battles over correct belief. This group that ended up winning the battles for correct belief decided which books to include in the New Testament and decided what Christians were to believe for all time. They wrote the Christian creeds that have come down to us today. This victorious party, the group that emerged from the conflicts as victorious, the historians call the Orthodox Party. Not because they think this group necessarily was right in all of its views, but because this group was the one that was able to determine what the right beliefs are for Christians for all time. The Orthodox Party opposed Marcion. It also opposed the Ebionites. And it opposed another group that I've referred to in previous lectures, a group known as the Gnostics. The Gnostics are a wide-ranging group of religious persons who subscribe to a range of religious beliefs and practices. There were a number of different Gnostic groups. Their views are not necessarily compatible with one another, but there are certain things that all of these groups that scholars call Gnostic had in common. All of these Gnostic groups agreed that the world that we live in is an evil, material place that needs to be transcended by the spirits that have been entrapped here. The Gnostics are called Gnostic from the Greek word gnosis. Gnosis is a Greek word that means knowledge. Gnostic groups insisted that correct knowledge is the way of salvation. One needs to have the knowledge of who one really is in order to escape this material world. The idea is that people are trapped in this world. At least some people are trapped in this world. Some Gnostics maintained, in fact, that there are three kinds of person in the world. Three kinds of person. There are some people in this world who are pure animals, like my neighbor. These are people who are simply like mosquitoes and gnats and cats and rats and other animals. When they die, that's it. That's the end of their existence. They exist no longer. That's one group of persons. There's a second group of persons for the Gnostics, for some Gnostics, who are a group of people who actually can have an afterlife. These are people who can have faith and do good works, and as a reward, God will give them an afterlife in heaven. This will be a good existence after this life. But there's a third group. And by the way, that second group is what would be the normal Christians, the ordinary Christians. But Gnostics insisted there was a third group of insiders, of elite Christians, who have the true knowledge of the faith. These are the Gnostics themselves. These Gnostics maintained that they, in fact, had a pre-existence, that they are entrapped spirits, entrapped in the body, that they can be set free from the body when they acquire the correct gnosis, the correct knowledge of existence. And when they're set free by the saving knowledge, they can return then to the realm whence they came. These spirits pre-existed in a heavenly existence, and they came into this world and were trapped here, but if they return, they'll have a glorious afterlife, living in the world of God Himself. How did Gnostics try and explain, though, how the spirits came to be entrapped in this world? Different Gnostic groups, had different myths that they used to explain the entrapment of divine sparks in this world. There were a range of Gnostic myths. Different groups had different mythologies, and part of the complication of studying Gnosticism is trying to correlate these various myths with one another. And so I won't be able to explain all of the various Gnostic myths, but I can give you an example of a kind of Gnostic myth that can explain how it is people came to be entrapped here, how sparks came to be entrapped in this material world. According to one of the Gnostic myths, the way it happened was this, and I should say, in broad outline, This myth is comparable to other Gnostic myths. The details differ significantly, but this is a common type of Gnostic myth. According to one form of the Gnostic myth, in the beginning there was God, who was a truly spiritual being and completely spiritual, and He was the only thing in existence. Completely spiritual, nothing material about Him. This God is not only the unknown God, He's a God far beyond our knowledge. He's an unknowable God. God is not only unknown, He's unknowable. Why unknowable? Well, because we know things through our senses. We may think that we have thoughts that are unconnected with our sense experience, but in fact, everything that we think is somehow connected to one of our senses. It's connected to something that we've seen, or heard, or felt, or smelt. Our various senses are what inform our thoughts. But this God is immaterial. Our senses recognize only what's material. This God, therefore, is not only unknown to us, he cannot be known. He's unknowable. This, and I guess I should say that, as often happens even today, when you have some Christians will say something like, God is far beyond what we can think or imagine, and then they start telling you his characteristics, which is, of course, an irony, since if he's beyond what we can know, then you can't know. Well, that's comparable to what happens with the Gnostics. They indicate that there was this unknowable God, and then they start telling you about him. So this unknowable God, in eternity past, had certain emanations that came forth from him, which were also divine beings. Because this God did have certain characteristics. This God, for example, was alive. He had life. And so life itself becomes an entity, a being, a divine being. This God was eternal. And so eternality becomes a divine being. This God was all light, no darkness. And so light becomes a divine being. From this God, there emanate other divine beings, substances. In one form of the Gnostic myth, these other divine beings emanate out in pairs. And so there end up being several sets of pairs. In fact, three sets of pairs. First, eight divine beings that are sometimes called eons. These emanations from the one true God are called eons. There were first eight, and then there was another set of ten, as some of the eons themselves emanated other divine beings. First eight, then ten, and then 12. A total of 30 divine beings, emanations from the one true God. In one of these Gnostic myths, the 12th of the 12 divine beings was a divine being called Sophia, wisdom. Sophia, the Greek word for wisdom. Wisdom wanted to understand the entire divine realm, but in so doing, she overreached her grasp. She wasn't designed to understand the entire divine realm, even though she was called wisdom. She overreached her grasp, and she fell from the divine realm. In her fall, she conceived another emanation, but she fell apart from her consort. All the other emanations were in pairs, so that every new emanation came from a previous pairing. She, though, conceives by herself without her partner, so that her offspring is imperfect and partial. This imperfect being that comes into existence with the fall of Sophia is, in fact, the creator of the material world. This demiurge, this maker, demiurge, this maker, makes the material world and declares that he is the only God who exists. I alone am God, and there is no other besides me. That may sound familiar to you. Those are the words of the God of the Old Testament in the book of Isaiah. I alone am God. This demiurge, this false offspring of Sophia, misunderstood his own existence and thought that he was the only God. The only God that mattered, that is, because he did know about Sophia as a competitor. This God and his minions end up entrapping his mother, Sophia. They create the material world as a place of imprisonment for Sophia. They divide his mother, Sophia, into a million pieces and entrap her in this world in human bodies. Some humans, then, have a spark of the divine within them. The spark of Sophia that is longing to be set free. How can the spark of Sophia be set free? Only by learning how it is she got here. There are people with a spark of the divine within, and they need to come to know how they came to be here, where they came from, and how they can return. If they receive this kind of personal knowledge of who they really are, then they can escape their entrapment in this material world. Gnostics, then, give this secret knowledge, this knowledge of the truth of one's real being. People who are Gnostic, then, the Gnostics themselves, receive this knowledge, and upon the death of their body, they can return to the heavenly realm whence they came. And so not everybody is a Gnostic. Not everybody has the spark within. Only some people have the spark within. How, though, are they supposed to get the knowledge? Well, they can't get the knowledge simply by looking around the world and thinking hard about it and figuring it all out, because that involves using your sense experience. The only way that one can receive the knowledge of the real world, the divine realm, is if a figure from the divine realm comes down and reveals the secret knowledge. In these Gnostic systems, Christ is a divine being who comes from the divine realm to reveal the secret knowledge that's necessary for salvation. And once you learn that knowledge, then you can be set free. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free, as it says in the Gospel of John, a gospel much liked by many Gnostic groups, because the Gospel of John portrays Jesus as a divine being who comes to earth to reveal the truth necessary for salvation. This is very amenable to Gnostic views. The Orthodox people, of course, oppose the Gnostic interpretation of John as they opposed Gnostic interpretations more broadly of various scriptures, because the Gnostics were particularly inclined not to accept the literal surface understanding of the scriptures. This is where they differed significantly from Marcion. Gnostics understood that just as Sophia is entrapped within the body, so too true knowledge is entrapped in the literal words of a text. One needs to go below the literal words to see the true spiritual meaning if one is to understand the sacred writings. And in a number of instances, they came up with very interesting interpretations of scriptural texts that others thought were in fact outlandish, others who were non-Gnostic. For example, some Gnostics believed, as I've pointed out, that there were 30 divine beings in the divine realm, a set of 8, a set of 10, and a set of 12. Evidence that there are 30 divine beings for some Gnostics came in the circumstance that, according to the Gospel of Luke, Jesus began his ministry when he was 30 years old. Why 30 years old? Because it's a symbolic representation of the divine eons, of the divine beings. The idea that the 12th of the duodecad, the 12th of the group of 12, Sophia, was the one that fell from the divine realm leading to this miserable material world, was shown by the fact that it was Jesus' 12th disciple, Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. The 12th disciple betrayed him. That's, in fact, a symbolic representation of the fall of Sophia from the divine realm. Gnostics had symbolic interpretations of the writings of Scripture. They wouldn't accept the literal interpretations, which made them very difficult to argue with, because it was impossible to point to a passage of Scripture and say, see, you're wrong because this text says this. Because Gnostics would say, well, yes, it says that on the surface, but what it really means is this. Yeah, but it says that. Well, it doesn't matter what it says. This is what it means. Very, very difficult to argue with somebody like that, as it's difficult to argue with a Gnostic generally, because a Gnostic is someone who has knowledge. And if you're not a Gnostic, you don't have knowledge. And so if you disagree, it's simply because you're ignorant. Yes, but that's not right. Well, that's what you think, because you're ignorant. I have knowledge. Very difficult to argue with that sort of view. The Church Fathers, who were of the Orthodox persuasion, in other words, the Church Fathers whose views ended up winning out, argued against the Gnostics, and as it turns out, argued quite effectively. In other words, they convinced more people so that they ended up winning. They argued that these kinds of figurative interpretations were wrong because these Gnostic figurative readings of Scripture had nothing to do with the literal meanings of the text. There's an effective image used by one of the Church Fathers, a Church Father named Irenaeus. Irenaeus said that the Gnostics interpreting scriptures are like somebody who takes a gorgeous mosaic of a king, a mosaic made out of colored stones, and this person takes this mosaic of the king and rearranges the colored stones so that now they take on the appearance of a mongrel dog. And then they claim that that's what the artist had in mind all along. That's what the Gnostics do. They take the literal meaning of the text and they rearrange things so it ends up looking completely unlike what it originally looked like. And so the church fathers, the Orthodox church fathers, argued against this kind of figurative interpretations of Scripture. What's striking to historians, though, is that even Orthodox church leaders used figurative modes of interpretation when it suited their own purposes. The church father Tertullian, for example, argues for a literal interpretation of the text, but whenever it suits his purposes, can talk about a symbolic meaning of the text. Before him, the church father Barnabas interpreted the laws of the Jews found in the Jewish scripture as symbolic meaning, as having symbolic meaning. Laws including things such as the law of circumcision, which he thought doesn't really mean that you should cut the foreskin of your baby boys. No, it's a symbolic statement that you should believe in the cross of Christ. The Sabbath, why the cross of Christ, you ask? Well, it's a little complicated, but what Barnabas says is that the father of the Jews, Abraham, was the first to circumcise, and he circumcised 318 of his servants prior to leading them off to war, according to the book of Genesis. Why 318, asks Barnabas? Because it's a symbolic number. In Greek, when you write out the number 318, you use letters of the alphabet. The letters are tau, iota, eta. Tau looks like our T. It's in the form of a cross. Iota, eta are the first two letters of the name Jesus. And so the circumcision of 318 is actually the cross of Jesus. Barnabas concludes by saying, "No one has ever learned a better lesson from me." And I'm sure he's right. He interpreted the Sabbath laws symbolically, the kosher food law symbolically. The church fathers, when it suited their purposes, could interpret the scriptures symbolically rather than literally. Even so, the Orthodox Christians who eventually won out in these battles stress that texts primarily needed to be interpreted literally in order to know what God meant to teach by them. And only then could they be interpreted following figurative modes of interpretation, that you couldn't use figurative modes of interpretation to overturn literal interpretation. And so despite their somewhat ambivalence on the issue, it can be said that for most Orthodox leaders, the literal mode of interpretation was to be given preference to the symbolic in trying to decide what it is the scriptures really mean. These debates over how to interpret continued on for centuries. Throughout most of Christian history, to the discomfort of many Christians today, figurative interpretations were both sanctioned and encouraged. For most of Christian history, symbolic interpretations of Scripture have been completely acceptable, even encouraged. Eventually, though, with the Reformation and the Enlightenment, the literal approach to interpretation came to be championed and privileged, so that today it simply seems like the commonsensical way to read a text. You read a text literally. We need to remember, though, that this is common sense because of what common sense means. Common sense means a sense that is shared by the majority of people at any given time. Common sense views are not necessarily true, they're simply widely shared. For much of Christian history, common sense indicated that the scriptures are to be read symbolically, but especially with the Reformation, when Martin Luther insisted that the text itself is the final authority in all matters of theology, he had to insist on a literal interpretation of the text because otherwise a symbolic interpretation could lead to other views. The insistence in the Reformation of sola scriptura, scripture alone, as the guide for true theology, led to an insistence on the literal interpretation of the text, so much so that people in the modern world read texts almost always literally rather than symbolically. In sum, There were wide debates in the early church over how to interpret the text of Scripture. Although these debates have subsided by now, their significance has not. Christians continue to disagree in fundamental ways about what their sacred texts teach, about what to believe, and how to live.